Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I am your host, Todd Embley, and today I am thrilled to be joined by Dean Diabaty, an expert in the world of China e-commerce and China to both of Africa and European Union trade relations. From his early career beginnings in Paris, Dean recounts his initial venture into China's burgeoning e-commerce sector, the pivotal transitions that led him to Alibaba, and the lessons he learned along the way. A significant part of the conversation focuses on the opportunities for African industries on Chinese e-commerce platforms, which Dean helped drive as part of Alibaba's EWTP program. Dean also discusses his experiences managing business development for the pet, beauty, and personal categories at Tmall Global, highlighting key consumption trends and growth opportunities for international brands in these categories. He also elaborates on why cross-border e-commerce has become a crucial channel for tapping into China's vast consumer market. Dean then addresses the major changes currently reshaping the e-commerce landscape and offers strategic advice on how brands can succeed in this evolving market. Finally, the discussion turns to his relocation to Bali, his thoughts on Indonesia's rising economy, and the vibrant e-commerce scene in Indonesia that is increasingly attractive to global brands. Enjoy.
For any brands that is interested in starting in China, the number one thing to do is to understand the market, because so many overseas brands will think, oh, you know, our products and our brands are selling well in our local market. We're sure that they will sell well in China, forgetting that China is a different market with consumers that have different preferences and that use different platforms to pay, to shop, to even get their stuff delivered to their house, etc. So this part of the work for any brands that want to launch into China is so important. Number one, understand the Chinese consumer, understand how they shop, why they shop this kind of products versus that kind of product, etc., etc.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Dean, welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Standard opener, my friend. Where in the world are we recording you from today?
All right. So today, I'm actually in Bali, Indonesia, which is where I moved just about, just last September, actually. I just moved to Bali.
Yeah. A lot of people like myself are familiar with Bali. I've mentioned on the podcast before that my wife and I got married in Bali. Whereabouts in Bali have you kind of settled down?
So I've settled in a village called Umalas. It's within the Canggu Regency. So I'm sure you'll be familiar. A lot of listeners will be familiar with Canggu. It's where you've got all the action, basically, where everything's happening, right?
Geographically, what quadrant of Bali kind of is that? Southeast? Southwest?
It's southwest of Bali, close to the sea.
You have had a remarkable journey from Paris, being a key figure in China's e-commerce landscape. Can you share with us the early days of your career, how you ended up in China, and everything you've been doing since then?
Yeah. So, so I'll backtrack a little bit to my career, how it all started basically with China. I went to China for the first time in February 2008. At that time, I was a student back in France, Paris. I was studying finance in a private school, focusing basically on international trade and business. And in the third year of university, I was able to either choose a work abroad program or go for a study abroad program. And I decided to go for the work abroad program. And I decided to go to China. And of course, at that time, you know, being 21 years old, a lot of my friends were like, "Are you crazy to go to China? I mean, no one does that," because at that time, China didn't have a very good image in the West, right? So, and I was like, "Have you ever been to China?" And no one told me yes. So I said, "Okay, I'll go and I'll come back with a report." And so I went to China, worked in private banking as an intern for 6 months. And then after finishing that internship, I unfortunately didn't have enough capital to pay for my last year of school. So I called my mom, called the school, and I said, "Guys, I will have to take a 1 year gap because I need to basically really focus on making money and pay for the last year of school." And so everyone said, "Okay." Mom's school said, "Okay." And so I went to work for another private bank. And I worked for another private bank for about a year, and I was able to amass enough capital to then free up and go pay for my last year of school, which I did, went back to Paris, finished my degree, ended up, the last day of school was in March, and in March I was back to Shanghai. So I got back to Shanghai and I decided that I was going to do something completely different, because I realized finance was not so much for me anymore, and I wanted to explore something new. So I went to the world of advertising.
It's just so funny because, well, so often I just graduated with a degree in such and such, and then had realized that such and such was not really for me anymore. So then I went.
Exactly. So I went to the total opposite. So that's what I did. Yeah, that's what I did. I went to work in the advertising world, learned tons of new things. And China at that time was becoming, you know, was part of becoming the powerhouse that it is today in e-commerce, advertising, etc. And the country was, you know, back in 2010, it was really revolutionizing a lot of the ways that we see and experience e-commerce. And, you know, I was dealing with technologies like big data and AR and VR already back in 2012, 2013. And I realized that, okay, I'm trying to bring all these technologies to the market, but obviously it's too early for China. And it's still at its sort of infancy when it comes to changing the whole economic model of e-commerce, et cetera, right? And so 2011, I started my own agency representing a few talents and doing digital consulting for major e-commerce places and brands and so on in China. And I kept this agency until 2016. And the reason why I say 2016 is because 2014 to 2016 were key years in China where you had the massive event of influencers boom, as well as cross-border e-commerce events. So a lot of these, a lot of the things that shape e-commerce today actually originally back in 2014, 15, and 16. And so I was in that transition phase of the entire e-commerce industry in China. And as a foreigner doing business in China in the e-commerce and digital consulting world, I unfortunately wasn't able to survive. And I looked at myself and I said, "Dean, what's next for you? What can you do?" Right. So I said, I really need to go and maybe join a major company in China to start learning again what's actually happening in the country. Right. And so I applied for a few jobs, went on a few interviews. And Alibaba Group popped up on my WeChat Moments at some point that they were launching a program, a management trading program called Alibaba Global Leadership Academy, or AGLA in short. Alibaba had just gone IPO in 2014. And it was at that time the largest IPO in history. And so the company was, you know, obviously looking at major expansion, financing a lot of new projects with China, but also with other countries outside of China. And that program that was created by Jack Ma was a program that actually really meant a lot for the group, because if you're talking about a Chinese company trying to expand overseas, you're talking about a company that needs to adapt to new markets, new cultures, new languages, et cetera. And unfortunately, we all know that some Chinese company that try to go global have a hard time with globalization because they're very rigid on how they do business, even overseas. And so Jack had this idea to actually bring selected people or selected few people to actually join this program for about 15 months and learn from the inside at the headquarters of Alibaba Group, how the company is run, how people work, the cultures, and so on and so forth. And then after that program is finished, send those people to their home country and run the offices of Alibaba Group with the understanding of how the company runs and so on. So I was lucky because I got to do three rotations, one in rural Taobao, the second one in AliExpress, and the third one at Tmall Global. So rural Taobao essentially is a e-commerce marketplace that helps to connect the countryside and the farmers' products to the cities. So essentially building the e-commerce marketplace for the trade between the countryside and cities of China. The second business, AliExpress, is one that a lot of the listeners will know probably because that's the platform that you use to buy, I would say, individual parcels from factories in China. And then the third rotation was Tmall Global. Tmall Global is kind of like the Amazon of China, but it focuses on cross-border. So essentially doing B2C e-commerce, helping brands from overseas get listed onto Tmall Global's platform and then sell to the Chinese consumers using the e-commerce, the cross-border infrastructure in China.
That's such an incredible, yeah. I mean, to have those three, to do rural to urban e-commerce, then do China to global e-commerce, and then global to China e-commerce. That's the trifecta. That's really amazing.
I think I got lucky with this one, to be honest.
Yeah, especially with those three. I mean, I don't know. You got to be good to be lucky, though. And obviously, you're very good at what you do. So, and that's pretty amazing. And I think we could talk a lot about that. But I want to fast forward a little bit to something a little bit more current. If you're like me, it's a little bit, that's a past life almost, yeah. Even though we're, you know, and you're still so young. But the stuff that you've been doing, I think around, you know, the African industries and China e-commerce is something I want to lean in a little bit right now. So can you talk a little bit about what you've been doing with regards to that trade corridor? And then what is the opportunity for African businesses and industries for in the China e-commerce landscape?
It all started in 2018 for me, my involvement in the China-Africa trade business. I remember I was at the office of Alibaba Group at the headquarters in Hangzhou, China, and I was doing my, you know, my normal work that I do every single day, which is helping overseas brands come to China. And my manager came to me with, you know, a very happy face saying, "Hey, Dean, there's a project with Jack Ma that just came up. It's called EWTP. EWTP stands for the Electronic World Trade Platform. And it was an initiative by Jack to kind of level up the playing field for all the businesses globally and help all the global businesses as well as trade agencies to understand how to put the right mechanisms, the right resources, the right tools in place in order to facilitate global trade. And so Jack created that initiative in order to do that. And one of the very first project that he launched under EWTP umbrella is the EWTP Rwanda. And so 2018, I was asked by my team to lead the project of EWTP Rwanda, which was divided into three segments. Number one, trade segment. Number two, tourism segment. And number three, the teaching segment, or kind of like the way to share the knowledge of Alibaba Group to businesses in Rwanda, politicians in Rwanda, so that they could put forward the right policies to facilitate trade. And so I was the leader for the trade segment. And the trade segment, as you can guess, my role was to essentially identify which brands, products, and categories were going to be traded between Rwanda and China, but from Rwanda to China. So that means I was responsible for identifying the right category and the right brands to launch in China using the Tmall Global and beyond Tmall Global's platforms to help them then launch in China. So I did that, and I selected coffee because a lot of people will know that the Rwandan coffee is actually one of the most sought after in the world. You know, even brands like Starbucks source their coffee beans from Rwanda, but they also do that from Uganda. So basically strategically located in a very, very good part in Africa with tons of volcanic soils, et cetera, et cetera. Rwanda is a perfect country for coffee production. And so I identified three brands from Rwanda, and I launched the program of launching them in China through Alibaba Group. And so what happened there is that I organized a few things. Number one is I organized a few trainings in Rwanda and in China for businessmen from Rwanda, but also politicians in Rwanda, to basically get them to understand the ecosystem of the entire ecosystem of e-commerce in China, but also the entire Alibaba ecosystem, because it's very complicated, sophisticated. You really need to understand it in order to make the most out of it. So I did that. And then in October 2018, I launched a campaign in Alibaba Group to start promoting the coffee from Rwanda to China. Bear in mind that the Chinese consumers or the Chinese, you know, citizens had no idea that Rwanda even existed, let alone had no idea that it was a major coffee production, a coffee producer in the world. And so we had to go through this kind of education campaign where we put up tons of content into some of the major platforms in China in order to educate the consumers about the country, about its assets of being a major coffee producer in the world. And that worked. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of people that got exposed to the content of Rwanda, exposed to the products that Rwanda was making, including the coffee that I was promoting. And of course, that raised a lot of, you know, curiosity from the Chinese consumers, because they were like, oh my God, so what is this country? I need to research. So they went online, they started talking about the country, et cetera. And fast forward a year later, Rwanda has become one of the top five countries in terms of coffee import in China. And it didn't exist prior to that. It wasn't even in the top 10 prior to that campaign. And so much so that Rwanda now has strategic partnerships with major companies in China, including major distributors in the coffee industry, who created sort of brands, Chinese brands with coffee beans from Rwanda. And of course, that benefits a lot of the coffee producers in Rwanda. But we all know that most of the bucks actually come from launching your own brand in a market, right? So launching those three coffee brands helped them to increase their profits, get them to reinvest in their own supply chain, production capabilities, et cetera. And now they're actually able to supply a lot more of their branded products to China. So all of this has helped And that's backed up by data. It's more than 100,000 coffee farmers from Rwanda have increased their profit by more than $5 after that program was launched in Rwanda. And so much so that even CNN made an entire piece on that in CNN Africa, CNN Africa Marketplace, talking about how the campaign that we've launched in China has benefited the country, its coffee producers, and its coffee brands.
To switch gears off coffee, I want to move to, because you also did a bunch of BD, or business development for pet, beauty, personal care categories for Tmall Global. So share some of your views just on those categories. I know that they've boomed and, you know, it's all up and to the right. But what trends are driving consumption growth and creating opportunities for brands in those sectors?
That's a very good question, because actually the categories you just mentioned, not only they're booming categories, but they're actually, if we look at the pet category, it is probably the smallest category in e-commerce, but it's the fastest growing category in e-commerce in China. Personal care and beauty, the largest e-commerce category in China. When I talk about these sort of insights, I'm referring to the GMV that they're generating. So pet is small in terms of GMV, but it's the fastest growing category. And beauty and personal care are the largest categories in terms of GMV, and now stabilizing in terms of how fast they're growing. Now, the reason why these three categories were booming at the time and still today. So if we look at the pet category, right? So I was leading the business development efforts for Tmall Global for about 5.5 years for the pet category and for about 2 years for the beauty and personal care category until I left Alibaba Group last June. So pet was booming all this time simply because less and less adults or, you know, adult workers in China were getting married and having kids. And so just like the trend that we've seen in Western countries, they replaced having kids by having a pet. And when we talk about pets, we talk about dogs and cats mainly, right? Back in 2022 and 2023, there were more than 100 million pets in China, and mainly dogs. But the cat population was rising so much faster than dogs because they need less care than dogs, right? Easier for white collar workers or blue collar workers to actually take care of them while they're at work.
But also look at the way they live, right? I mean, just a quick little tangent, but especially in the urban centers, and which is where you would probably see the highest growth of cats versus dogs, because you're all vertical. It's apartments. And, you know, dogs, you'd have to like get in the elevator, go all the way down, take them out, come back. So cats would necessarily, if you can keep them indoors, easier. Due to the way they live, in a way.
For sure, for sure. And so my role at Tmall Global was essentially to identify the best brands from Europe to actually bring into China on Tmall Global. And obviously, this is a category that, you know, was growing extremely fast. We're talking about 25 to 30% growth year on year. In Tmall Global. And in terms of the category itself, pet category itself, it was actually extremely hard to get brands to come to China simply because there were a lot of regulatory issues between China and Western countries, especially in Europe. What do I mean by that? So in order to ship any given, you know, pet food from, for example, let's say Germany to China, you needed to have your factory in what we call the GACC whitelist, which is kind of an import body in China that that gives the approval for XYZ factories overseas to ship its ingredients and its products to China. And so any factory that wanted to ship pet food to China needed to be on the on that white list. Second, there were some restrictions on which ingredients by country could enter China. I'll give you another example. If we look at Germany again, for example, Germany was not able to ship pork, beef, or poultry products to China. And that ban happened around COVID time in 2021. So prior to 2021, you could imagine that actually a lot of German pet food brands went to China because, oh my God, this is the gold rush. And Germany is known for being an amazing country when it comes to having the best pet food brands in the world. And then 2021 hit, that ban happened, and unfortunately, a lot of German brands had to stop. And the reason why the government did that, one of the reasons is because they obviously want to have homegrown brands. So having pet food brands from China, developing their own products, helping factories locally to also harness the ability to compete with overseas factories and so on. So tough years between 2021 and until now. It's still very tough because of those regulatory bans, but still a tremendous amount of opportunities. Now, when we talk about beauty and personal care categories, so the beauty and personal care categories, we put them together in Alibaba Group as one category, but then we separate them within the teams. So beauty and personal care, you must remember probably when you were in China, how Korean, you know, celebrities got extremely popular and very famous. And that popularity of, you know, K-pop and Korean culture and all this stuff obviously brought tons of other trends from Korea to China, not only fashion, but also obviously beauty and cosmetics and makeup products and so on. So a lot of that came from Korea, and we've seen, you know, major growth of cosmetic Korean brands and tremendous success of these brands into Chinese e-commerce. And a lot of Chinese consumers were now starting to resemble almost Koreans, you know, same kind of skincare regimen, same cosmetic products from Korea. I even use Korean products for my personal care regimen, for example. But yeah, but a lot of consumers started adopting Korean products as part of their daily skincare routine. And so we've seen that Chinese consumers not only wanted to get healthier, wanted to look a lot more you know, beautiful, I would say beautiful in their own way of seeing beauty, but essentially helping to really, really push on that physical aspect, which meant a tremendous growth in the beauty and personal care category. Now, when we look at the category of beauty and personal care in itself, Alibaba Group has started this event called Double 11 or Singles Day, which happens every November 11th as a way of, you know, kind of like a massive shopping festival, which could be compared to, for example, Amazon's Black Friday or Cyber Monday, etc. But just the size in terms of GMV, gross merchandise value, is a lot bigger in China. And every single year, ever since this event started in 2009, if I remember correctly, the personal care and beauty categories came number one in terms of GMV contribution for the total e-commerce across all the platforms and across all the marketplaces. But we've seen in 2021 and 2022 that because the Chinese consumption market started slowing down, meaning people started spending less and less money, that these categories also suffered tremendously from a decreasing growth because Chinese consumers started spending less money in terms of, do they need five skincare products? No, they only need two or maybe one. And so that realization of the Chinese consumers' mindsets have really helped to not only sort of decrease a bit of the very useless spending, but has been also the reasons why now the Chinese economy is suffering a little bit, because the Chinese consumption is changing. And on the supply side, because we also look on the supply side, so which means on the number of brands that go to China or the number of distributors that represent skincare and other personal care brands, tons of competition in China. And I'm talking about not only that there are a lot of overseas brands that want to launch in China, but you have also the same as in the pet category, a lot of homegrown Chinese local brands that understand the Chinese consumers a lot better, are able to position themselves in terms of pricing a lot better, and that produce locally, and that offer products that are a lot more competitive than their foreign or overseas counterparts. And so the market in beauty and personal care has become tremendously competitive, leading to now, you know, a very fierce fight between all the e-commerce or the brands that play in that market.
This is the way the world works. It always has. I mean, when there's maybe new categories where more mature markets want to enter into countries where that market is seeing growth, the foreign incumbents or the foreign brands may be the incumbents for a certain amount of time. But then as homegrown gets better and starts to mature and grow themselves, then there's lobbying and pressure put on the government. There we come the tariffs. And it's like, hey, listen, you should be supporting the local homegrown, make it an unfair playing field a little bit, tilted towards us because we are keeping money in-house and keeping it here. And every country in the world does it. China takes a bit of a beating more often for it, just because they have the largest economy in the world. And so people are like, oh, it's unfair, they're making it more difficult for us. Well, yeah, of course, because they're supporting their own. And wouldn't every other country always, they always do that as well. So I don't think you can really hurt them for that. And, you know, it's such a massive economic market. Everybody wants to be a part of it. So thank you very much for that. Thank you. There's been some major changes taking place in the e-commerce landscape. Could name a lot of them, live commerce and just like in all the platforms and the PDDs and then the Xiaohongshu and just everything, right? So talk to us just a little bit maybe about how brands, educate brands on how they can position themselves for success in the e-commerce landscape in China.
Yeah, so that's a very important question that you're, or sort of I would say requirement for brands, because part of my work as a business development advisor at Alibaba Group was to actually educate brands on how to launch to China.
Oh, perfect question then.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but it's important. This is what everybody's eager for. They want to know, like, what are the tricks? Like, tell us, what is the gold?
Yeah, I think, you know, I've done a few videos about that. And I mentioned through these videos that, you know, the number one thing to do for any brands that is interested in starting in China, the number one thing to do is to understand the market. Because so many overseas brands will think, oh, you know, our products and our brands are selling well in our local market, we're sure that they will sell well in China, forgetting that China is a different market with consumers that have different preferences and that use different platforms to pay, to shop, to even get their stuff delivered to their house, etc. So This part of the work for any brands that want to launch into China is so important. Number one, understand the Chinese consumer, understand how they shop, why they shop this kind of products versus that kind of product, et cetera, et cetera. The second part that is extremely important is to actually look for a good partner to collaborate with, whether it is what we call a distributor, or it is a TP. In China, a TP stands for a trade partner, which is an outsourced e-commerce agency that any brands that doesn't have a local Chinese team in China or in-house can outsource that type of the e-commerce work to a third-party agency that will help them with understanding, for example, how their products can fare against the competition, how much they could generate in terms of revenue, what type of marketing investment they have to make, which platform to launch into, under which model, et cetera, et cetera. So once the brand has decided, okay, well, we're going to, you know, collaborate with a distributor and or a TP, because it's possible to work with both, then the third part comes in, where the brand has to understand, okay, which marketplace are we going to go into? And how much marketing investment are we willing to make in order to launch into China? So there's a rule of thumb in China that just at Tmall Global, for example, if you as a brand want to launch in Tmall Global, in the first year, if your revenue target is, let's say, $1 million in revenue, you must be ready to put upfront about 30 to 40% as a new brand into marketing. So that's the equivalent of $300,000 to $400,000 just in marketing for the first year. So that's a rule of thumb for any given brand that wants to launch in a platform like Tmall Global, for example. I'm not doing any advertising for Tmall Global. I don't work for them anymore, but I'm just saying that that's really the rule of thumb that any given marketplace will give brands. The other part is, and that's the fourth point, is really to understand, okay, now that we know, you know, we have kind of a business plan, et cetera, now we need to know which business model are we going to get into in each of these platforms. Now, China has become a very sophisticated e-commerce market. Each platform, whether it's Pinduoduo, Douyin, which is the equivalent of TikTok, it's under the same parent company called ByteDance, Jingdong, Little Red Book, Xiaohongshu, WeChat, et cetera, all these e-commerce players have developed their own e-commerce capabilities. Now, if you look at e-commerce in China, you have two ways to enter into China as a brand. Number one is what we call general trade. Number two is what we call cross-border. If you enter via general trade, it means that you register your company in China. You register your trademark in China. You have a bank account in China. You also have potentially a local team and a local warehouse in China to do your fulfillments. But if you do cross-border, you do everything from overseas. No need to register your trademark in China. No need to have a warehouse in China. No need to have a local team in China. You can do everything from overseas. And the payments, you register either via cross-border payment platforms or via local payment platforms, via a local bank account. So all these e-commerce platforms I mentioned earlier have developed different capabilities based on these two ways to enter China. For example, if we look at Alibaba Group, it has developed, just for brands, tremendous capabilities on the direct import business model versus the platform business model. And all of the companies that were competing against platforms like Tmall, Tmall Global, Taobao, et cetera, all the platforms of Alibaba Group have developed also the same capabilities versus that were direct import versus cross-border, versus platform model. And direct import means that the marketplace itself becomes the wholesale buyer of the products from a given brand. So they will buy wholesale certain types of products that they that the platform thinks will succeed in its e-commerce marketplaces, right? And so for the brand, it's a perfect way to generate quick cash, quick revenues, because you sell wholesale to a marketplace that has tremendous amount of needs for products that already sell very well in China, because that's the way for the marketplace to reduce its risk, is by buying products that already sell well in China and it's an own marketplace. But the second business that I refer to is the platform business model. And the platform business model is essentially that the brand will open, for example, its own flagship store online on Pinduoduo, on Douyin, on Xiaohongshu, on Tmall, et cetera, et cetera. So it will open its own virtual market, own virtual shop in order to sell to the Chinese consumers. And of course, when I refer to business models, there are tons of different shops, kinds of shops that a brand can open. It can open a flagship store, or it can work with a distributor or a reseller to open a specialty store, or it can work with the marketplace to open a store that will be sort of a way for the brand to test what we call long tail products into a store that costs less in terms of operation costs. It costs less in order to test different products. And then once certain products from these test phases work well, they will take those products and launch them into their flagship store. So tons of different models, tons of different ways of entering China through cross-border versus general trade, through direct import versus platform, and then within those business models, how and which type of store do you choose also becomes key and tremendously important for the success in China.
Okay. Dean, masterclass. I love it. No, but I mean, it's all true. You've worked with them. I mean, it's rare that we speak to somebody with that granular background going back even to Rwandan coffee or coffee bean producers and farmers, and bringing them all the way on to, you know, the Alibaba, Taobao platform, Tmall Global platform. You've done it from end to end, right? So you really, really know what you're talking about, meaning that everybody listening should really take to heart everything that you just advised them to do if they're going to enter China. Now, you mentioned off the top that you are recording this from Bali. You've moved to Bali. Tell us a little bit about what prompted the move and what you're up to now that you're there.
Yeah. So my first trip to Bali was in October 2018 during the Golden Week holiday. I was still in China at the time. And one of my best friends, told me, "Dean, let's go to Bali for about 10 days. Came to Bali for the first time. I fell in love with the place, the energy, the people, the food, the landscapes, the activities. And I promised myself that I will come back to Bali. And so between 2018 and 2019, I had come back to Bali already about four times, just within those 2 years. And in 2020, COVID happened, right? And China got hit pretty hard. And I remember that, you know, between 2019 and 2020, I also told myself that I was going to prepare for my move to Bali in 2023. And I already had this planned since 2019. And I said it will happen in September 2023. And so what happened during 2020, during COVID, was that I was looking for my exit of Alibaba in 2023. And I said, I need to prepare very well. I need to kind of look at the best places for me to invest in real estate and generate passive income. And so I started looking into different countries, different parts of the world and regions. I looked in Latin America. I looked in Northern America. I looked in Europe, of course, Africa, Asia, Central Europe. It took me about a year and a half of research, and Bali was always coming number one in terms of where to invest. So I invested in real estate in Bali in 2020, and the price of real estate at that time were very, very interesting, to say the least, for an investor. Very, very reasonable, much more below market price. So I got in at the time when the real estate market was crashing down in Bali. So I got properties for a very good price, and I was able to then really sort of capitalize on that. So fast forward 3 years after my real estate acquisitions, I've moved to Bali in September 2023. So that's just last year, with two very important objectives. The very first objective was to set up a real estate agency that would help any given person to invest in Bali the same way as I did from overseas markets. And obviously, with my experience of living and working 15 years in China, our focus is actually the Chinese investor. So there is this part which I have set up already with my partners. We have the company registered in Hong Kong and so on. And now we're full-fledged operational and already helping a few investors find their properties here. But the second business is kind of my passion project. Because I don't know if you know, but I've been rollerblading for the past 35 years. And rollerblade is my passion since since the age of 3 years old. And during COVID, when I was in China in 2021, I actually was looking for, you know, a better way to live my life because COVID in China was so harsh on us that I said, I need to do something that I love to do. And I started with a video. I started shooting a video of myself teaching people how to skate, how to do the basic movements in skating, how to fall, how to skate, what stance to take, how to turn, etc.
How to stop.
Exactly, how to stop. And I did that video and I posted it on Little Red Book, Xia Hongshu. And that video went viral. And fast forward about 2 years now, I'm Asia's number one inline skating influencer. And I have registered the company in Bali, Indonesia, to become a company that will help bridge the skating culture that we have from the West and bring it to Asia. So essentially really helping the Asian markets, not only in China, but also in Indonesia, in Japan, in Korea, etc., to really kind of get onto that culture of skating the same way as I did when I was a kid back then. So these are the two businesses that I focus on right now. Apart from, you know, investing, I still invest myself in real estate, but I run those two businesses as the founder and CEO. And that's it.
Last question for you. Just given your background and now where you live, what are your thoughts on Indonesia's emergence as a major economy? Obviously, we have, 280 million people there, something 250, somewhere in there, right? Was it 240? I don't know.
270.
But then as an economy and a market for international consumer brands, and just what is the e-commerce scene like there?
Yeah, I think, obviously for me to come to Bali was both by passion, but also a strategic move, right? Because if we look at the Southeast Asian market, Indonesia, if I remember correctly, Indonesia's e-commerce market is about 50% of Southeast Asia's total e-commerce market.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So just that number alone tells you about the trends that will take place in this economy. Now, Indonesia is 17,000 islands with over, if I remember correctly, 700 languages spoken across Indonesia as well. So just these numbers tell you about the opportunities, but also the complexity of the Indonesian e-commerce market. Now, if we compare Indonesia to China, China is just one block where everything is centralized around, you know, sometimes just a very few players in payments, a few players in logistics, et cetera, et cetera. But because of the amount of languages, the amount of islands, et cetera, then Indonesia is a very complicated market to penetrate. However, with the youth that is now using its mobile phone constantly to shop online using platforms like Shopee, Tokopedia, and else, Gojek, Go and Grab as well. All these platforms now are extremely well penetrated in the market to basically capitalize on helping other brands come into Indonesian market. So I look at Indonesia as a Chinese market probably 10 years ago, where there is still a lack of infrastructure and the lack of connectivity between, you know, not only between the islands, but also between the countryside and the cities. Just like I mentioned to you earlier, you know, I did that work at rural Taobao, where we were in charge of connecting the rural countryside of China to the cities using our marketplaces. I see that, you know, coming full force in Indonesia within the next coming years. There is going to be still tremendous growth when it comes to B2C e-commerce, C2C e-commerce, but also B2B e-commerce, because Indonesia is known for being a very good producer of, you know, interior design products, home products, furnitures, and so on. And so I know a few players in the country who are putting together marketplaces in order to help local Indonesian furniture manufacturers to ship not only within Indonesia, but also globally. And so we're going to see more and more initiatives like these coming forward in Indonesia to not only service the local markets, but also to service the global market using technology that is already predominant in China, like payments, big data and infrastructure for cloud services, as well as consumption trends and habits that will be fulfilled by the demand from overseas market, but also local market. And of course, everything fueled by the youth engagement of, you know, the young people using TikTok all the time, using Instagram and Facebook all the time, using WhatsApp all the time. All these platforms are going to adapt to the new consumer trends and develop new solutions to service not only the brand side, but also obviously the new trends that are coming in e-commerce.
Dean Diabati, thank you very, very much for being on the show. He is one of the leading experts on the realm of China e-commerce and in Africa, EU-China trade relations, as well as Indonesian real estate and inline skating in Southeast Asia, well, all of Asia, actually. Thanks, man. Appreciate you being on the show. You're a wealth of information. Can't thank you enough.
Real pleasure, Todd. Today. Thank you for having me.
For everybody, a quick reminder, if you're watching us on the YouTube video, don't forget we have the audio only podcast if you need your hands and your eyes for other things. And for those of you listening to us audio only, don't forget we do have the YouTube shorts and the full episode on the YouTube channel over at the WPIC YouTube channel. But for me, for everybody at The Negotiation, and for Dean, thank you all very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.